Parts of Alaska have housing shortages, and it's hard for many of the state's most vulnerable residents to find secure, stable places to live. Organizations and government agencies around the state are coming together to try to fill the gap, but it's going to require new types of collaboration. Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll discuss what's happening behind the scenes to develop more affordable, transitional, and supportive housing, and what needs to happen next.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Do you need health insurance for next year? Did you know Alaska's individual market health insurance rates have dropped by more than 20% for 2018? More than 90% of Alaskans who sign up at healthcare.gov are eligible for tax credits to help pay the costs. Open enrollment is November 1st through December 15th of this year. Check out healthcare.gov to find out what your insurance options are for 2018. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact this station to learn more. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska, and I'm Ann Hillman. Today, we're discussing the state's housing needs and what can be done to meet them. This program is part of Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk. Joining me today in Anchorage are Michelle Brown with United Way of Anchorage and Sezi Jero Hansen from Cook Inlet Housing. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And at the KTOO studios in Juneau is Brian Wilson with the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. Thanks for joining us, Brian.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you to all of our listeners. I'd like to invite you into the conversation as well. Do you have ideas for developing more housing? Do you think we need it? Let us know by calling 550-8422 in Anchorage or 1-800-478-8255 statewide. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. So before we jump wholeheartedly into this conversation, I just would like, Brian, if you could lay out what the state's needs are. How many people is it or estimated to lack housing?
Yeah, sure. So the information that I could speak from is from our information database that our organization manages, the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. I could say that housing is an issue that needs a lot more conversation around it. As of October 10th of this year, we've seen over 12,000 individuals hit our system. So these are folks that are in need of some sort of housing services, not just homeless folks, but folks that are at risk of losing maybe or getting evicted from their apartment or losing a housing situation because of some extenuating factors. And unfortunately, what we've seen is only about a third of those individuals that have hit our system have been able to exit to what we consider a permanent housing situation. So either a rental, rental with a subsidy, or supportive housing, which has really led to an increase in what we consider doubled up or couch surfing situations. And to be honest, that number is probably likely underreported due to how the federal government defines homelessness in our country and how it doesn't really apply to our village communities that are in the middle of a housing crisis of their own related to severe overcrowding.
What do you mean it doesn't apply to the villages? Like it's because people have why doesn't it apply to there?
Sure. So every year in January, HUD directs Continuum Care Organizations, which is our organization, for the balance of state in Alaska to report.
So wait, let's pause for a second.
Yes.
Balance of state just means outside of Anchorage?
Yeah, that's correct. Outside of Anchorage. And then Anchorage okay. also reports the same numbers.
Okay, and Continuum of Care?
Yeah, continuum care is basically just a term. Sorry, I'm getting a little jargony here.
Yeah, that's why I'm pausing you. No worries.
Sure. Yeah, so continuum care is basically just an organization that is responsible for advocacy and education around housing and homelessness issues as well as managing the overall system within their territory. So in Alaska, we have two continuum care organizations, one in Anchorage, and then the other is our organization, which is for the rest of the state.
So basically, organizations that are looking at housing shortages, homelessness issues. And
yeah.
Each year in January, you do the point in time count.
Yeah, each year in January, we do a point in time count, and we have to report up to the federal government, you know, this is how many people we have that are experiencing homelessness in our community. But unfortunately, the definitions that are used at that level don't take into consideration folks in a doubled up situation. I guess the example that I always use around this is I just visited the village of Savunga a few months ago and visited several homes that were probably no larger than 800, 900 square feet that had anywhere from 14 to 26 people living in them. A lot of these homes were in very substandard conditions, black mold, broken heaters, no windows. And unfortunately, we can't pass those numbers up to the federal government and say, look, these are folks that are in just as bad of a situation than folks who may be on the streets in Anchorage or Juneau for that same night. Go ahead.
And so looking at when you're estimating that 12,000 number, that's mm-hmm. just people who have absolutely nowhere to go?
Yeah, well, it's a variety of causes. Like I mentioned earlier, this could be people seeking what we consider preventative services, so preventing them from becoming homeless. So maybe they have an eviction notice on their door or they lost their job and they need some temporary rental assistance. Or it could be an individual that accesses an emergency shelter somewhere in the state. So as I mentioned before, as of year to date up to the middle of October, our system's seen over 12,000 individuals.
And that includes Anchorage?
That includes Anchorage.
And so, Michelle, can you jump in here and kind of give me a picture of what you're seeing here in our urban hub?
Yes, thank you. One of the most telling markers is people who call Alaska 211. It's just dial 211 and you can get connected to health and social services anywhere in the state. And in the last 3 months, we have had well over 600 calls for people who are feeling housing pressure. They're either not housed now or they're imminently at risk of losing their housing. Rent and utility assistance is consistently the number one request that people have. So there are extreme pressures on our housing market, all the way from people who are currently experiencing homelessness, but throughout the entire population. When we did an analysis several years ago with many of our partners, including Cook Inlet Housing, we saw there was a shortage of affordable housing and a shortage of housing overall to meet the need across the entire housing continuum. That's people experiencing homelessness who need to move into housing, all the way to people who are seniors and want to downsize. We called it housing gridlock because there was not sufficient affordable stock that people who would normally move up as their income increased and then downsized as they got older, they couldn't do that. And so there was no place for people who were homeless to even begin to get into housing. Because of what the lack of stock and the lack of affordability, the homes that were less expensive in our community were not necessarily available for moving people in who were starting in their housing stability because they were held by people who were unable to move to the next layer of housing. So that's why we called it housing gridlock. And we can't even begin to help people who are experiencing homelessness if we don't address this issue of affordability in our housing stock.
And Cezzy, you're with Cook Inlet Housing, and you're known for addressing affordable housing. First off, what exactly is affordable housing? Is that like a definition we should work with or just like something people can afford?
So it is a definition, and it means that any one household shouldn't spend 30%, more than 30% of their household income on housing. So that's relevant to everyone. No matter what your household makes, that should be your mark. And so the challenge is when you spend more than 30%, if you're spending 50, 60, and 70% of your household income, which many of our families families are. That puts a stress on other things, and then you're just one catastrophe away, you're one illness away from being homeless. And you're making decisions like, how much food can we buy? Can we pay the utilities? Can we pay the rent? Those are the challenges when you have inaffordability. So we're striving to make sure that people can afford at every spectrum. That includes whether my household can afford to live how we live, and whether someone who's on a minimum wage can afford to live how they want to live. So those are that's the definition of affordability. And we're talking about just, we need a whole spectrum. Every household's different, and we need a spectrum of sizes. We need a spectrum of affordability, different rents, different levels for, you know, for all the people that make up our community.
And so how do you, given that there's this whole spectrum of need, how do you decide what to focus on?
Yeah, so we have to pick what we can affordably, feasibly construct. And that's the challenge in Anchorage and across Alaska. The cost of land, the availability of land, even though we're a giant state, we're not all developable land. And then construction costs, since we have to bring everything into the community that we're going to build with. So we have to choose and look at different properties and different styles of housing, and what are the sources of funding available. It's competitive funding. It's very difficult to fund these. Sometimes it takes 10 pieces of funding to put one building together. And so you have to make a lot of decisions and just kind of look at the market and see what the market can bear for rents. And then, does that pencil out? Can you get enough rent to pay for the construction of the building? That's a big challenge. It doesn't always pencil out.
So you bring up, you have to piece together these different pieces of funding. Brian, I'd like to jump to you. In the past, we've talked a little bit about different ways this is possible on a statewide level, including the creation of sort of a housing trust. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So our coalition is an advocacy body for the balance of state of Alaska, well, the state of Alaska as a whole, for housing and homelessness issues. And so we talk a lot about, you know, the need for ensuring that housing is happening, the housing conversation is happening at all appropriate levels. And we talk about the need for increased collaboration among different funding entities, so existing money. But in reality, we have multiple grant streams and multiple funding sources to put projects together, but a lot of those are really tied up funding or just keeping afloat existing programs. As our state has gotten a lot better at tracking housing needs in a variety of different communities, those communities have come together and put together a series of project proposals for existing grant streams, but have found that there's really no new programmatic money out there. And so it's really important that we do begin the conversation about some sort of revenue stream to help fund new housing projects out there. Alaska is one of three states in the entire country that does not have a statewide housing trust fund, which is basically a fund that is earmarked to address housing needs that could range from folks who are experiencing literal homelessness to folks that Ceci was describing that are just really hitting a brick wall in terms of affordable housing availability. We understand that right now it's a really tough fiscal environment in the state, but these types of funds and long-range planning opportunities take a while to put into place. We won't always be in the situation that we are right now, but if we don't begin having those conversations right now to how a fund like that may be constructed at the state level, we're really just kicking the can down the road, and it'll be just that much longer before we put this vital piece in place.
And I'd like to invite listeners into this conversation. You can call us at 550-8422 or 1-800-478-8255. Where does the conversation about housing start in your life? Where does the conversation about funding start in your life? Join the conversation. Michelle, he's talking about funding streams. He's talking about coming together. What's happening here in Anchorage?
I wanted to stress what Brian was saying, and that is one of the really exciting things I think that has happened over the last several years is people realizing we can't solve this problem project by project, program by program, fund grant. We have to come together, and there's been this incredible movement to do that, to set some clear goals that we want to achieve, be it more housing stock, be it reducing homelessness, and figuring out what are our best levers that we can work on together. Policies, maybe at the state or the local level, innovative funding streams, blended funding, all kinds of things like that that will help all along the housing spectrum, not just project by project. We need desperately these projects, but that won't get us out of the hole alone. And I've seen an incredible shift, I think, in Anchorage as well as the rest of the state, of people realizing none of us alone, no matter how well we work, are going to solve this. We have to come together. And so we are seeing those kind of discussions happening now. What are the policies that will really change this for everyone? The second thing, though, I want to raise, because in this context of not having silos, we have to think beyond simply construction and new units. What do the folks who move into these units need to be sure they are self-sufficient and stable? And particularly people who have been struggling, who are, as Sezzy said, one paycheck away from crisis. We have to look at all of that as one package to make sure people are housed. We need housing units of all kinds, and we need to be able to support the people who live in them, be case managers or neighbors helping neighbors. There's a lot of great work on coaching and neighbors just helping each other. So I just wanted to raise that point. Let's not forget, people live in houses, so building them is not enough. We have to also be working with the folks to give them their best shot at stability.
Yeah, I would echo that, and we see the most success when we're able to partner and put all of our capacity and our strengths on the table and see who does what lane best, and can we do some complementary work, and can then we come together, that advocacy at the state level and for other funding sources is really important. And I think when we get out of our silos and we really just come transparently to the table and we work together collaboratively, we're able to come up with some innovative solutions, and we're able to address more of the problem than if we're just going to work in our own lane and just kind of keep our heads down. And so we've seen great success in that kind of partnership in the neighborhoods we work in.
Tell me about some of the specific examples. Like you've incorporated childcare straight into your housing. You've incorporated give me some examples of what's going on.
I would say working with, we're not here to do it all, and we don't provide social services at Cook Inlet Housing Authority. We provide the housing, and we look for partners who can join us and add that support that Michelle was talking about, so that if you're a working family, one of the things you struggle with, every working family who has children in school struggles with childcare. And so can we bring that childcare through Campfire directly to our housing development? And we were able to do that here in Anchorage. And that is, that's peace of mind for the parents. That allows a parent to work past 3 o'clock or 3:30, work till 5 o'clock, and be able to come back to their apartment, and their child is in a Campfire program right there on site. And so again, when you're struggling to make sure you have enough gas in your tank to get to and from work, if you have one more stop to make to pick your child up off-site daycare, that's just one more stressor. So if you're able to just know when you're at work at 3:30 that your child's well cared for at Campfire and learning some skills and doing exciting things, that's something you don't have to think about. You can continue to work, and you can put in, get your 40-hour work week in and not have to worry about it. And that's an important part of success.
I definitely echo everything that Michelle and Sezzy just said. I think this also applies over to our folks who are most vulnerable as well. Oftentimes, our coalition will get a call and say, hey, Why don't you just build a bunch of tiny homes, or why don't you just put folks in shipping containers? There are roofs over their head. But really, it doesn't take into consideration the variety of needs that that individuals have that likely led to their housing crisis that they were in. And a great example of this is the Juneau Housing First collaborative project that just opened up 32 units of supportive housing.
Okay, wait. Before you go into this, you're going to have to tell me what Housing First is and what supportive housing are, please.
Oh, sure.
No problem. Definitions. It's crazy.
So I'll start with Housing First. Housing First is a model that that views housing as healthcare. There's been many studies that have shown across the nation that simply getting an individual into housing increases their physical health. It reduces the number of times that individuals are getting arrested or accessing emergency room services.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually also shown improvements to individuals' behavioral health. So substance abuse reduces when they go in. And then supportive housing is sort of what we've been talking about here. It's housing with what are referred to as wraparound supports, understanding that housing is just one leg to the stool to fix this problem. There are mental health and physical health supports that need to be put in place, vocational supports that need to be put in place.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the supportive housing idea. And so the reason why I jumped to the Juneau example is it's quite a unique program in this state and actually nationwide right now. They're really ahead of the curve where it placed 32 units of supportive housing that targeted the most vulnerable individuals in Juneau. So they surveyed everybody that they could find. It measured all these different factors related to health and mental health, substance use, how many times they've been arrested, and ranked individuals. The top 32 individuals got placed into this unit. But as I mentioned before, it's not just the housing component. It took a really creative partnership with the Juneau Alliance for Mental Health Incorporated, or some people call them JAMI. They co-located a facility on site where folks are going to be able to access counseling. They're going to be able to access health services, mental health services. None of these services are required for folks to enter. That's the Housing First philosophy there, create no barriers to housing. But just having the access there and ease of use, it's literally on the ground floor of the facility, is going to be a huge asset for the success of each of those candidates.
I'd like to talk about that in a little bit more depth later, but first let's go to the phones. We have Stu in Anchorage. Stu, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I've seen some progress with getting the homeless out under our current mayor here in Anchorage, out of the parks, that is, and I'd like to thank everybody for working on that. But as a person who lives in a condo association, I've seen what happens when units were provided to people who were obviously given some form of assistance. And I would just like to caution everyone involved with these programs to please recognize when people aren't competent to manage a condo or an apartment themselves. And what has happened in a situation I'm aware of is we had folks move straight from the park into a condo, and the next thing you know, the door's never locked. People are moving in and out of unknown origin. The windows are all broken in the unit now and plywooded up. And, you know, gosh, guys, how are you people going to deal with the bed bug problems? I mean, they're brought in, and what ends up happening is the condo associations end up forking the bill for all this stuff. So I would just suggest, after visiting friends in Cook Inlet Housing, where you have a controlled entrance on some units to multiple entrance, multiple units under, you know, a locked door, basically, when you have these people who probably are not able to manage a unit, put them in that kind of unit where somebody controls the entrance to the building.
Okay.
If you give them a entrance that's open air entrance, they tend to, you know, we have what we call needle dens in the parks. Now, they're not really occupied camps. They're places where people go to use opium. And they're really terrible to pick up. But what ends up happening is the needle dens move into the condo associations. And it's because it wasn't managed correctly. So
okay, Stu.
You've got to address those problems, and I hope everybody finds a home, because I don't want to sit on my couch and know someone's freezing to death 100 yards away in the woods.
Thank you. So, yeah, I'd love for Michelle and Tessie to both talk about this. Like, some individuals move into housing and they don't know how to live. Like, they talk about this.
Sure. I think, thank you, Stu. You're right on target. And I also want to thank you for your compassion for our neighbors that are experiencing going into this winter with no housing. What we are doing in Anchorage, along with this shift to Housing First that Brian described, because Housing First has been proven throughout the country, you get far better outcomes. The person who moves quickly into housing rather than staying in a shelter or even transitional housing does far better personally. Their children do far better. I mean, it's just the ripple effect is amazing. But as I said earlier, you must couple that with supports to help people build their self-sufficiency and become stable. So what we are trying to do now is, as we move people quickly to housing, is have them have a case manager who stays with them, or as I mentioned earlier, you know, other community supports, because neighbor helping neighbor and giving people a sense of community is incredibly important. And working with landlords, in particular on market housing, to figure out what site improvements might be needed, and also to have someone that landlord can call at the minute there's starting to be an issue, so the landlord doesn't have to deal with things that are outside, you know, his or her ability. They have someone to call, the case manager, someone to say, we have a budding problem. We don't want this to get out of proportion. Please come in and assist. So we're looking at both sides, making sure people have a house quickly, a house or, you know, a place to live quickly, and the support system in place that both they and the landlord can rely on before problems get out of control the way Stu just described them.
Because that happens sometimes, but not always.
It's certainly not always, but when it happens, you want to get it very quickly before it gets out of proportion and before neighbors get concerned that, oh, we don't want to move people in our neighborhood because this happens. And so this is a way to help everyone, helps the landlord, helps the tenant, because the end goal is stability for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say case management is a huge part, and Cook Inlet Housing is a landlord, and we experience the same challenges that Stu described. When people are moved into apartments from homelessness, some of them do not have the skills needed to be successful, and so having a case manager to go to allows us to help keep them housed. You know, it breaks our heart if we have to send someone out of a home that they've gotten into because they can't handle it. And so how can they handle it? You know, they need those supports. And certainly we're looking for partners, and we're providing some programming that helps them to attain self-sufficiency and to gain those skills. So we don't assume that everyone comes to us with all the skills that they need for budgeting and for being successfully housed. And we aren't social workers, we aren't caseworkers, but there are those things exist here. We just need to connect with them, and that will help provide that network and that safety net to keep people housed once we get them in the housing. And then you'll start to see all of those other successes come off of that stability that it provides to that family, then echoes into the stability of the neighborhood, and then echoes into the stability of our community.
Thanks very much for your call, Stu. I'd like to go to Kristen in Anchor Point. Kristen, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you very much. Well, I live down here on the peninsula, and, of course, homelessness is rampant down here. I mean, you can go around it too, because we have so much land down here that is not incorporated into any real town. Like, Anchor Point is not incorporated. It's a town, but it has no, like, government thing. And there's homeless people here. You can see them out in the woods. They build little shacks out on unused land that's dry and stuff like that. But basically, what I'm wondering about is how much the groups that want to do away with homelessness work with the various landlords and property owners, because there are problems. I mean, we've heard that people are moved into and they trash things, but there's also the opposite problem where people moved into an apartment that is substandard and rather trashed. They fix it all up. They make it very livable. And the next thing you know, they're being evicted because they can't afford the 400-500% increase in rent that takes place, because you've made the unit better. You know, you've made it look nice, so the landlord goes, oh, wow, I can get much more money out of this now. You know, pay it or out, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, on both sides, there's just needs for some kind of coming together where people's rights when they're in the apartment are protected, and where the landlord's rights are protected. But there doesn't seem to be any place you can go to get problems settled or discussed, or, you know, maybe just get things so people understand what's going on.
Brian, are there places and resources for both landlords and tenants and ways to solve this problem going through individual private landlords as opposed to through large, specifically built complexes?
It's definitely a gap that we need to improve on here. Every state has a Landlord-Tenant Act, which protects the rights of both tenants and landlords that can be referenced. And you can actually call up Alaska Legal Services to get guidance on that document. It's ran through the Attorney General's office. But I really want to emphasize the importance of increasing the conversation between agencies and landlords. An example that I have in the Matsu Valley is their Housing Homelessness Coalition puts on landlord liaison sessions, which is basically they bring in all the local area landlords, buy them lunch, and sit down and talk about, you know, the benefits to actually having folks who are maybe to opening up their units to folks who are under a subsidy, and the protections that they have to ensure that their place won't get all messed up because somebody doesn't have that skill set, and what they can do to ensure that it's a successful placement. And a lot of that is through case management. You know, if you're a landlord out there and you have those concerns, and those concerns are very valid, you know, it is important to if you are going to open your doors to this type of rental subsidy situation, that you're working with an organization that's making a placement that is prepared to ensure that that individual is being checked on at a regular basis, according to their own need. But yeah, I think what Kristen in Anchor Point mentions is a very valid point, is that it is a two-way street, and we'd hate to see folks, you know, moving into a place with improvements made and then just kicked out or gentrified, just as much as we'd hate to see folks have a door closed on an opportunity because of a lack of understanding of what that situation or agreement looks like.
Kristen, thank you so very much for your call. We are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more calls here on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we are talking about housing throughout the state, how to develop more, and what our housing needs are. If you'd like to give us a call, we're at 1-800-478-8255. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to go ahead and take another call real quick. We have Rich in McGrath. Rich, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Thanks for joining us.
My topic is about a situation where perhaps you're trying to come up with funding to build a housing for people to purchase, not to rent. And down south, I guess there's some places where they're building housing that are smaller footpads. You know, they cost less, their value is less. If more of those kind of units were available, people could more easily afford to get into them, have the down payment, and then the monthly mortgage payments. Mm-hmm. And that way they'd be able to stay into a place easier if they could afford to get into them initially. And that's the case for a lot of people who are, limited income or only one person's working in the household. I'm just wondering if you could touch on that for a second. You know, a place like that would be maybe easier to come up with funding to build if the cost was less.
Mm-hmm.
The only concerns I've heard is that those kind of subdivisions or those kind of housing bring down the value of other houses around them. I don't know what to say about that, but it would be easier to get into something like that. Mm-hmm. The overall costs were less, down payment was less.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're just up against the usual situation where you can't afford to get into housing,
Well, Ceci, jump in here, please.
Yeah, so we've worked a lot on trying to build smaller footprint homes, not a tiny home, but just a smaller square footage. The cost is still incredibly expensive, and I'm speaking for Anchorage. The cost of the land and then the cost of the infrastructure that goes with housing, the cost of the mechanical systems are still the same in small houses. And so we were seeing still a gap in affordability of what people who are on a kind of a low wage earner and what they could qualify for was leaving us at a $100,000 gap in what we could afford to build it for. So that's not a good model. Nobody wants to lose $100,000 on a home. So that's why you're not seeing private developers build small homes. And that's why we're not building homes for sale at this time, because it just wasn't financially feasible. And we're able to instead do the apartment home and make that work in a mathematical model. And home ownership isn't the answer for everyone. It's certainly starter homes are part of a healthy housing continuum. But again, it's not going to solve all of the challenges. There are still some code challenges that make small houses in Anchorage something that we can't build particularly. And I think, a lot of people watch HGTV and they see these tiny homes and they see you're building them in the South and they put the numbers up, and those numbers are not comparable in Anchorage. They just don't pencil. And so we're still looking and we're still pushing the envelope and we're still trying to find a way to do some kind of possibly cottage housing where you have several smaller footprint homes on a parcel of land. Of course, we are concerned. We want to build something that adds value to a community. And I think what Rich mentioned was, if you're going to bring the value down of homes around something, I mean, that's obviously not what we want to do when we're developing in a neighborhood, when we're doing infill development on a small lot that exists, or we're tearing down something that's past its useful life. It's maybe 50 years old. It was an old log cabin that's not efficient. We want to add value to a neighborhood, and we want to add value to the family that's going to live in the home. So we want them to have something they're proud to live in that's affordable, that's safe, and that's quality. So there's a challenge to find that balance and make that financially feasible. And we haven't quite found that magic bullet yet.
And
can I jump in on that?
Please, that's what I was about to invite you. Yeah.
Yeah, and so actually the governor threw a housing summit last year in 2016, there were a number of different breakout sessions, and the outcome of those breakout sessions were recommendations for the governor's office on how we can improve a variety of different housing-related topics. And one of the recommendations that came out of that summit was a proposal to amend the Alaska statutes related to comprehensive planning that municipalities have to do on a regular basis to include housing and homelessness issues as a required chapter in each area's comprehensive plan. Because as Ceci mentioned, there are a number of code issues that are prohibiting developers from being able to create this type of housing opportunity due to size and space restrictions, infill restrictions, accessory dwelling unit restrictions. And so we're hoping that the municipalities will become more of an engaged partner in these topics while they're going through their comprehensive planning process on a regular basis to identify opportunity areas where they'd like to see this type of development take place, which will also take into account the concerns that Rich from McGrath had about property values of neighboring neighboring neighborhoods and whatnot. So I think that's a budget neutral opportunity area that the for the legislature to consider moving forward, and something that our organization is actively advocating for.
Thank you very much for your call, Rich. I'd like to invite Don from Anchorage to the program.
So there was no mention about how much it does cost, other than you said at $100,000 difference. What do you pay for a house or a unit per person?
I know that's to Ceci.
I can't speak in a kind of a general term, but in the homes that we were building a few years ago, we were spending for a really small footprint of a ranch home $350,000. But when we were trying to house folks that were at 100% of area median income or below, they weren't able to qualify for that, and they were more in the $250,000 range. And so you're leaving $100,000 on the table to develop that. And that was a really modest home, small bedrooms, probably three bedrooms at the time, a really small living room, a kitchen. It included some landscaping, but very modestly built, very highly energy efficient, so that the utilities were affordable to someone who got in that was on kind of a fixed income, but still not something that was sustainable.
Versus if you're doing larger...
Isn't there plenty of houses for sale right now on the market? Less than that? I mean, how many square feet are you talking about?
Yeah, the square footage was, oh gosh, I want to say, I can't think of what they were, but certainly now, so this was, we were building probably 4 years ago, and certainly the economy has changed and the housing market has changed, and there are homes that are in the market that are for sale, but the price points are still pretty high. And what you're getting at the older homes that still need a lot of work. You might need to put another $100,000 into an affordable home that's for sale now that was built in the 70s, early 80s, where a lot of stock was built quickly, and it's not energy efficient, and it's really will need some investment. So there is some movement in the market now for sure. And that's part of why we stopped building. It wasn't penciling, and the market has changed.
I mean, $100,000 worth of improvements, that's a heck of a lot of money. I can't hardly believe that. I'm just getting that there's plenty of houses available to give someone a brand new house. That's like giving them a brand new vehicle so they can go to work too.
Yeah, we weren't giving anyone anything, actually. We were selling them, for sure.
Different than selling them a brand new vehicle when they don't need a brand new vehicle. Well, they need shelter.
But I think that what they're trying to get at here is that developing, like building new things, is expensive. And are there programs for upgrading older homes?
Yeah, certainly we have. Uh-huh. We've received some grant money from different sources that allow us to do weatherization and mold remediation and prevention work. What you see in some older homes is they're not ventilated properly. Mm-hmm. That's going to lead to some health challenges for the families that are in there. And that affects our community. It affects our hospitals and how our ER is used. And those are things that affect all of us in our community. Mm-hmm. So, there are definitely sources and ways that we can upgrade some of the housing stock that currently is available.
And Michelle, is that anywhere factored into, like, Anchorage has a very large community plan to end homelessness that factors in so many different things. Is that one of them, the idea of trying to upgrade current housing stock that is on the market?
Sure. We're looking at, we now have, for the first time with community partners, a coordinated list of people who are currently experiencing homelessness, so that we are now in the position to start assessing what type of housing do we need for these folks who are on the list, because some will do better in permanent supportive housing, as mm-hmm. Brian said, but many will do fine in community housing as long as there are supports to make sure that, you know, they have the employment skills to be self-sufficient and so on. So we are currently doing that analysis of what needs to be done new in the sense of permanent supportive housing or even new housing. But for the most part, we want to concentrate on existing community housing
mm-hmm.
and then work with landlords to see what is it that they would need in an ongoing relationship to open their units to folks who might not have the best housing history. So what kind of supports does the landlord need to do it? It gets back to the point that Kristen raised earlier is, you know, we have as providers, we tend to get, as Ezzy said, in our lane, you know, and so mm-hmm. we think we do these things about housing units and we do these things about case management supports and we do mm-hmm. employment supports. What we're trying to do in the Anchorage Community Plan is connect the dots between all of those because people don't live in silos.
Mm-hmm.
People have needs, you know, just like Kristen pointed out, you get into a house and all of a sudden your landlord wants to gentrify, you know. So how do you deal with have a system that deals with constant fluctuations in people's status or what their landlord needs or so on? And that's what we're trying to build in the community plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking at community-based housing and what kind of supports are needed to mm-hmm. make it successful for the existing landlords or existing developers
and also
the client.
And also ways, I mean, like people need housing, but they also need housing that's healthy housing, right? Like it's, you can't just be like, well, we've got this apartment that's falling mm-hmm. down and you don't have a place, so go live in it. Like you, I mean,
you're just going to compound their problems and mm-hmm. add to the stressed systems that already exist. So that's not really the solution.
So substandard housing, not the way
we
want.
Not the solution. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think that part of the other thing is, you know, if you're building some smaller new housing stock, I don't think that you know, your audience should think that that's where we're going to put people who are moving from homelessness. This is where we think our aging senior population might want to downsize from. They raised their family in a 5-bedroom, 4-bedroom house, and now they want to stay maybe in the same part of town where their friends and their church and their community is, and they are stuck because they can't find anything that's affordable for them. So if we are able to build, and they don't want stairs anymore, so we need some smaller ranch homes in the community, you know, scattered throughout, so you can downsize. So the family who's growing, who is maybe in a condo right now, who needs to move into a bigger house, has someplace to go. So that someone else who's in an apartment can move into a condo, and so that someone who's in homelessness right now can move into an apartment. That's the movement that we need to see. So when we talk about adding housing stock and adding units, it's not necessarily we're adding units so that homeless people can get into a new housing unit. It's so that there's a continuum and a movement in and a healthy movement within all of the stock that allows us to help people move from homelessness into starter apartments. But if someone's stuck in a starter apartment because they can't get into their first home, because someone can't move from a first home to their second home, because the senior who's in their dream home doesn't have a place to downsize to, we get stuck. That's the gridlock, and that's part of the challenge. And so when you add to the housing stock overall, all different types and sizes, then you start to get a healthy movement, and you're able to move people from homelessness into a beginner starter apartment.
All right. We are going to take a quick break, and then we will be back with more of your calls here on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Support for Public Radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about housing in Alaska. We have Jack from Anchorage on the line. Jack, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How about yourself?
Great. So I was listening to the discussion and the discussion about possible new construction and renovation of older properties. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the construction industry. Additionally, I recently opened a business. So this is personal experience. Additionally, I've had contractor's license in other states, so I can confirm that Anchorage is unique in the following way. Everything you build in Anchorage requires engineering and architecture at $1,000 per page. If you want to move one door 6 feet, add on $3,000-$4,000 for engineering. We saw this scenario play out at the new shelter over near Cordova there. Mm-hmm. It came to a cost of $300,000 per one-bedroom unit. So I did some looking, and sure enough, most of that money was swallowed up by engineering and architecture required under Title 21. This scenario also stops a lot of businesses from opening. I recently went bankrupt as a result of this, and I know about a dozen people who have two. Until we tackle the problem of architecture, engineering, regulation, and code within the municipality, every consequent discussion is a moot point.
Says he. I'm nodding in agreement. Our development and development finance team, they're incredibly talented, they're hardworking, and when they say something can't pencil, it has a lot to do with the code requirements and the challenges, and you know, time is money, that's part of it, and so if you spend a lot of time battling that, you know, we're losing our very short construction window to get foundations in. It's a snowball effect, and it's definitely something that we've been partnering with the municipality on. But as we talk about, you know, what are the solutions that the community can weigh in on? These are the things that community members can come to the assembly, talk to their assembly members about that can affect change. And there's been a lot of back and forth on Title 21. It is not a perfect document, and it is supposed to be an organic document, which means it's able to be changed. That takes the will of the people and the will of the assembly to get that moving. But I think that's, you know, for a call to action, it's to be involved in those discussions and think about the ramifications down the line to costs as you add all these regulations.
I can tell by your response that you are well-versed in this controversy.
We definitely have to mothball some fabulous developments because we aren't able to make them pencil due to those regulations.
Okay. Well, let me just throw this in before I go. Right. The Muni overlaid new code on top of old code last year. I'm sure you're aware of this. And when that happened, I'm sure you're aware of this too, construction virtually stopped in this state. If it's not a large corporate entity powering the construction, you know, that can afford attorneys and 8-9 months down at the office mm-hmm. on Elmore Road, if it's not that scenario, a large corporation, there is no construction in this city, and it will not change.
Yeah, I agree. And that's a challenge because it's going to take the private and the public sector developers working, you know, to meet the need. You know, Cook Inlet Housing isn't able to do, you know, all of that. We do what we do, and we serve a certain population. We need private developers who have a healthy place that we have certainly a lot of developers who are ready. They have land and they have plans, and they aren't able to make it financially feasible. They're not going to do it. And so, yeah, we need to have some changes. And that's something that if we had the community support to have those conversations with the municipality, with the assembly, then we might see some movement.
Thanks.
Wait, one more thing before I go. Mm-hmm. I own a small house on a lot in Fairview, mm-hmm. and the Muni has decided that I'm not allowed to put a tiny house in my backyard mm-hmm. and let a homeless person live there, and I've had it. I don't care what the Muni says. I'm building it, and I hope that other residents in Anchorage build a tiny house in their backyard that's illegal, and they put a homeless person in there. Have a good day.
Thank you for calling, Jack. I appreciate your call. Time for one last call. We have Kyle in Kodiak. Kyle, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi. I'm glad you guys are having this show. It's a critical issue. And it's, when I first came up here, I lived in Delta Junction, and then I lived in Haines for about 10 years, and now I'm in Kodiak. And previous locations, people were able to build their own houses and get started, and I wouldn't have got a foothold if I had to start out today and looking at $270,000 shacks and $300,000 houses, or have a contractor build me one for $300,000+. And it, what I see is a lot of these communities, Haines doesn't have a building code, Fairbanks in the borough doesn't have a building code, but out here in Kodiak and many other communities, the codes are getting so restrictive, and they just get more complicated and thicker and thicker. And just the structural code itself is a couple inches thick, and then you add the plumbing code, the electrical code. And so how's a high school kid, or somebody in their 30s that are making $22-$28 an hour, they can't afford the, $2,000 a month payments. Mm-hmm. It's just cost prohibitive. And so what you end up with is these kids are struggling. And not only with home costs, but the cost of health care and others, that, every time they try to grab the next rung up on the ladder, somebody's stepping on their fingers. And, they get frustrated, and they end up, I think substance abuse can probably be some of it attributed to that frustration and the fact that they just can't get a grip and can't get any traction. And if you allowed these people to build outside the city limits without a building code and have provide that as a voluntary exemption, then they can throw something up on the weekends with their friends. They can go grab some carpenters, some plumbers, some electricians. They don't have to go through the building permit process. They can avoid some of the code requirements. Mm-hmm. The argument you get from contractors, developers, realtors, and the fire department and all the people that, they're living in their nice homes. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, we don't want to allow people to live in an unsafe structure. Well, then you have them on the street. And, what's the better alternative?
Kyle, we're going to have to wrap up the program, but thank you for calling in with your comments and for joining us. I'd like to thank everybody who called in and joined us for Talk of Alaska today. My guests were Michelle Brown with United Way in Anchorage, Ceci Jero-Hansen with Cook Inlet Housing Authority, also in Anchorage, and Brian Wilson is with the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness in Juneau.
Local public radio station. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we are grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in.
Going without health insurance could be financially devastating. Healthcare bills are the leading cause of personal bankruptcy. Open enrollment for 2018 plans is November 1st through December 15th. A household of four with an annual income of less than $123,000 may qualify for federal tax credits to help cover premium costs. Get signed up for health insurance at healthcare.gov today. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.